person's mode of thought, dull, insipid, and impotent, presumes to impose itself on the most revolutionary party that history has ever known. End of Engels' quote. How can this panegyric on violent revolution, which Engels insistently brought the attention of the German Social Democrats between 1878 and 1894, i.e., right up to the time of his death, be combined with the theory of the withering away of the state to form a single theory? Usually, the two are combined by means of eclecticism, by an unprincipled or sophistic selection made arbitrarily, or to please the powers that be, of first one, then another argument, and in 99 cases out of 100, if not more, it is the idea of the withering away that is placed at the forefront. Dialectics are replaced by eclecticism. This is the most usual, the most widespread practice to be met with in present-day official social democratic literature in relation to Marxism. This sort of substitution is, of course, nothing new. It was observed even in the history of classical Greek philosophy. In falsifying Marxism in opportunist fashion, the substitution of eclecticism for dialectics is the easiest way of deceiving the people. It gives an illusory satisfaction. It seems to take into account all sides of the process, all trends of development, all the conflicting influences, and so forth. Whereas in reality, it provides no integral and revolutionary conception of the process of social development at all. We have already said above, and shall show more fully later, that the theory of Marx and Engels of the inevitability of a violent revolution refers to the bourgeois state. The latter cannot be superseded by the proletarian state, i.e., the dictatorship of the proletariat, through the process of withering away, but as a general rule, only through a violent revolution. The panegyric Engels sang in its honor, and which fully corresponds to Marx's repeated statements, see the concluding passages of The Poverty of Philosophy and The Communist Manifesto, with their proud and open proclamation of the inevitability of a violent revolution. See what Marx wrote nearly 30 years later in criticizing the Gotha Program of 1875. Footnote: The Gotha Program. The program adopted by the Socialist Workers' Party of Germany in 1875 at the Gotha Congress, which united two German socialist parties, namely the Eisenachers, led by August Bebel and William Liebknecht, and influenced by Marx and Engels and the Lassallians. The program betrayed eclecticism and was opportunist, because the Eisenachers had made concessions to the Lassallians on major issues and accepted Lassallian formulations. Marx, in his critique of the Gotha program, and Engels, in his Letter of Babel of March 18th through the 28th, devastated the Gotha program, which they regarded as a serious step backwards compared with the Eisenach program of 1869. End footnote. See what Marx wrote nearly 30 years later in criticizing the Gotha program of 1875, when he mercilessly castigated the opportunist character of that program. This panegyric is by no means a mere impulse, a mere declamation, or a polemical sally. The necessity of systematically imbuing the masses with this, and precisely this view of violent revolution, lies at the root of the entire theory of Marx and Engels. The betrayal of their theory by the now prevailing social chauvinist and Kautskyite trends expresses itself strikingly in both these trends, ignoring such propaganda and agitation. The supersession of the bourgeois state by the proletarian state is impossible without a violent revolution. The abolition of the proletarian state, i.e., of the state in general, is impossible except through the process of withering away. A detailed and concrete elaboration of these views was given by Marx and Engels when they studied each particular revolutionary situation, when they analyzed the lessons of the experience of each particular revolution. We shall now pass to this, undoubtedly, the most important part of their theory. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2. The Experience of 1848-51. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Section 1. The Eve of Revolution. The first works of mature Marxism, The Poverty of Philosophy and the Communist Manifesto, appeared just on the eve of the Revolution of 1848. For this reason, in addition to presenting the general principles of Marxism, they reflect to a certain degree the concrete revolutionary situation of the time. It will, therefore, be more expedient, perhaps, to examine what the authors of these works said about the state immediately before they drew their conclusions from the experience of the years of 1848-51. In The Poverty of Philosophy, Marx wrote, "The working class, in the course of development, will substitute for the old bourgeois society an association which will preclude classes and their antagonism, and there will be no more political power groups, since the political power is precisely the official expression of class antagonism in bourgeois society." End quote. It is instructive to compare this general exposition of the idea of the state disappearing after the abolition of classes with the exposition contained in the Communist Manifesto, written by Marx and Engels a few months later, in November 1847 to be exact. Beginning of quote. In depicting the most general phases of the development of the proletariat, we trace the more or less veiled civil war raging within existing society up to the point where that war breaks out into open revolution, and where the violent overthrow of the bourgeoisie lays the foundation for the sway of the proletariat. We have seen above that the first step in the revolution by the working class is to raise the proletariat to the position of the ruling class to win the battle of democracy. The proletariat will use its political supremacy to wrest, by degree, all capital from the bourgeoisie, to centralize all instruments of production in the hands of the state, i.e., of the proletariat organized as the ruling class, and to increase the total productive forces as rapidly as possible. End quote. Here we have a formulation of one of the most remarkable and most important ideas of Marxism on the subject of the state, namely, the idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat, as Marx and Engels began to call it after the Paris Commune, and also a highly interesting definition of the state, which is also one of the forgotten words of Marxism, the state, i.e., the proletariat organized as the ruling class. This definition of the state has never been explained in the prevailing propaganda and agitation literature of the official social democratic parties. More than that, it has been deliberately ignored, for it is absolutely irreconcilable with reformism, and is a slap in the face for the common opportunist prejudices and Philistine illusions about the, quote, peaceful development of democracy. The proletariat needs the state. This is repeated by all the opportunists, social chauvinists, and Kautskyites, who assure us that this is what Marx taught. But they forget to add, in the first place, according to Marx, the proletariat needs only a state which is withering away, i.e., a state so constituted that it begins to wither away immediately, and cannot but wither away. And secondly, the working people need a state, i.e., the proletariat organized as the ruling class. The state is a special organization of force. It is an organization of violence for the suppression of some class. What class must the proletariat suppress? Naturally, only the exploiting class, i.e., the bourgeoisie. The working people need the state only to suppress the resistance of the exploiters, and only the proletariat can direct this suppression, can carry it out. For the proletariat is the only class that is consistently revolutionary, the only class that can unite all the working and exploited people in the struggle against the bourgeoisie, in completely removing it. The exploiting classes need political rule to maintain exploitation, i.e., in the selfish interests of an insignificant minority against the vast majority of all people. The exploited classes need political rule in order to completely abolish all exploitation, i.e., in the interests of the vast majority of the people, and against the insignificant minority consisting of the modern slave owners, i.e., the landowners and capitalists. The petty bourgeois democrats, those sham socialists who replaced the class struggle by dreams of class harmony, even pictured the socialist transformation in a dreamy fashion, not as the overthrow of the exploiting class, but as the peaceful submission of the minority to the majority, which has become aware of its aims. This petty bourgeois utopia, which is inseparable from the idea of a state being above the classes, led in practice to the betrayal of the interests of the working classes, as was shown, for example, by the history of the French revolutions of 1848 and of 1871, and by the experience of socialist participation in bourgeois cabinets in Britain, France, Italy, and other countries at the turn of the century. All his life, Marx fought against this petty bourgeois socialism, now revived in Russia by the socialist revolutionaries and Menshevik parties. He developed his theory of the class struggle consistently, down to the theory of political power of the state. The overthrow of bourgeois rule can be accomplished only by the proletariat, the particular class whose economic conditions of existence prepare it for this task, and provide it with the possibility and the power to perform it. While the bourgeoisie break up and disintegrate the peasantry and all the petty bourgeois groups, they weld together, unite, and organize the proletariat. Only the proletariat, by virtue of the economic role it plays in large-scale production, is capable of being the leader of all the working and exploited people whom the bourgeoisie exploit, oppress, and crush, often not less but more than they do the proletarians, but who are incapable of waging an independent struggle for their emancipation. The theory of class struggle, applied by Marx to the question of the state and the socialist revolution, leads as a matter of course to the recognition of the political rule of the proletariat, of its dictatorship, i.e., of undivided power directly backed by the armed force of the people. The overthrow of the bourgeoisie can be achieved only by the proletariat becoming the ruling class, capable of crushing the inevitable and desperate resistance of the bourgeoisie, and of organizing all the working and exploited people for the new economic system. The proletariat needs state power, a centralized organization of force, an organization of violence, both to crush the resistance of the exploiters and to lead the enormous mass of the population, the peasants, the petty bourgeoisie, the semi-proletarians, in the work of organizing a socialist economy. By educating the Workers' Party, Marxism educates the vanguard of the proletariat, capable of assuming power and leading the whole people to socialism, of directing and organizing the new system, of being the teacher, the guide, the leader of all the working and exploited people in organizing their social life without the bourgeoisie and against the bourgeoisie. By contrast, the opportunism now prevailing trains the members of the Workers' Party to be the representatives of the better-paid workers, who lose touch with the masses, get along fairly well under capitalism, and sell their birthright for a mass of pottage, i.e. renounce their role as revolutionary leaders of the people against the bourgeoisie. Marx's theory of the state, i.e. the proletariat organized as the ruling class, is inseparably bound up with the whole of his doctrine of the revolutionary role of the proletariat in history. The culmination of this rule is the proletarian dictatorship, the political rule of the proletariat. But since the proletariat needs the state as a special form of organization of violence against the bourgeoisie, the following conclusion suggests itself. Is it conceivable that such an organization can be created without first abolishing, destroying the state machine created by the bourgeoisie for themselves? The Communist Manifesto leads straight to this conclusion, and it is of this conclusion that Marx speaks when summing up the experiences of the revolutions of 1848 to 1851. Section 2, The Revolution Summed Up. Marx sums up his conclusions from the revolution of 1848 to 51 on the subject of the state we are concerned with in the following argument contained in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. Quote, but the revolution is throughgoing. It is still journeying through purgatory. It does its work methodically. By December 2nd, 1851, the day of Louis Bonaparte's coup d'état, it had completed one half of its preparatory work. It is now completing the other half. First, it perfected the parliamentary power in order to be able to overthrow it. Now that it has attained this, it is perfecting the executive power, reducing it to its purest expression, isolating it, setting it up against itself as the sole object, in order to concentrate all its forces of destruction against it. And when it has done this second half of its preliminary work, Europe will leap from its seat and exultantly exclaim, "Well grubbed, old mole!" This executive power, with its enormous bureaucratic and military organization, with its vast and ingenious state machinery, with a host of officials numbering 500,000, besides an army of another 500,000. This appalling parasitic body, which enmeshes the body of French society and chokes all its pores, sprang up in the days of the absolute monarchy, with the decay of the feudal system, which it helped to hasten. The first French Revolution developed centralization, but at the same time, it increased, quote, the extent, the attributes, and the number of agents of governmental power. Napoleon completed the state machinery. The legitimate monarchy and the July monarchy added nothing but a greater division of labor. Finally, in its struggle against the revolution, the parliamentary republic found itself compelled to strengthen, along with repressive measures, the resources and centralization of government power. All revolutions perfected this machine instead of smashing it. The parties that contended in turn for domination regarded the possession of this huge state edifice as the principal spoils of the victor. From Marx's The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. End quote. In this remarkable argument, Marxism takes a tremendous step forward compared with the Communist Manifesto. In the latter, the question of the state is still treated in an extremely abstract manner, in the most general terms and expressions. But in the above-quoted passage, the question is treated in a concrete manner, and the conclusion is extremely precise, definite, practical, and palpable. All previous revolutions perfected the state machine, whereas it must be broken, smashed. This conclusion is the chief and fundamental point in the Marxist theory of the state. It is precisely this fundamental point which has been completely ignored by the dominant official social democratic parties, and indeed distorted, as we shall see later, by the foremost theoretician of the Second International, Karl Kautsky. The Communist Manifesto gives us a general summary of history, which compels us to regard the state as the organ of class rule, and leads us to the inevitable conclusion that the proletariat cannot overthrow the bourgeoisie without first winning political power, without attaining political supremacy, without transforming the state into the, quote, proletariat organized as the ruling class, and that this proletarian state will begin to wither away immediately after its victory, because the state is unnecessary and cannot exist in a society in which there are no class antagonisms. The question as to how, from the point of view of historical development, the replacement of the bourgeois by the proletarian state is to take place is not raised here. This is the question that Marx raises and answers in 1852. True to his philosophy of dialectical materialism, Marx takes as his basis this historical experience of the great years of revolution, 1848 to 1851. Here, as everywhere else, his theory is a summing up of experience, illuminated by a profound philosophical conception of the world and a rich knowledge of history. The problem of the state is put specifically: how did the bourgeois state, the state machine necessary for the rule of the bourgeoisie, come into being historically? What changes did it undergo? What evolution did it perform in the course of bourgeois revolutions, and in the face of the independent actions of the oppressed classes? What are the tasks of the proletariat in relation to this state machine? The centralized state power that is peculiar to bourgeois society came into being in the period of the fall of absolutism. Two institutions most characteristic of this state machine are the bureaucracy and the standing army. In their works, Marx and Engels repeatedly show that the bourgeoisie are connected with these institutions by thousands of threads. Every worker's experience illustrates this connection in an extremely graphic and impressive manner. From its own bitter experience, the working class learns to recognize this connection. That is why it so easily grasps and so firmly learns the doctrine which shows the inevitability of this connection, a doctrine which the petty bourgeois democrats either ignorantly or flippantly deny, or still more flippantly admit, quote, in general, while forgetting to draw the appropriate practical conclusions. The bureaucracy and the standing army are a parasite on the body of bourgeois society, a parasite created by the internal antagonisms which rend that society, but a parasite which chokes all its vital pores. The Kautskyite opportunism now prevailing in official social democracy considers the view that the state is a parasitic organism to be the peculiar and exclusive attribute of anarchism. It goes without saying that this distortion of Marxism is of vast advantage to those Philistines who have reduced socialism to the unheard-of disgrace of justifying and prettifying the imperialist war by applying to it the concept of, quote, the defense of the fatherland. But it is unquestionably a distortion nevertheless. The development, perfection, and strengthening of the bureaucratic and military apparatus proceeded during all the numerous bourgeois revolutions which Europe has witnessed since the fall of feudalism. In particular, it is the petty bourgeois who are attracted to the side of the big bourgeoisie, and are largely subordinated to them through this apparatus, which provides the upper sections of the peasants, small artisans, tradesmen, and the like, with comparatively comfortable, quiet, and respectable jobs, raising the holders above the people. Consider what happened in Russia during the 6 months following February 27, 1917. The official posts, which were formerly given by preference to the Black Hundreds, have now become the spoils of the cadets, Mensheviks, and socialist revolutionaries. Nobody has really thought of introducing any serious reforms. Every effort has been made to put them off, quote, until the Constituent Assembly meets, and to steadily put off its convocation until after the war. But there has been no delay, no waiting for the Constituent Assembly in the matter of dividing the spoils of getting the lucrative jobs of ministers, deputy ministers, governor generals, etc., etc. The game of combinations that has been played in forming the government has been, in essence, only an expression of this division and redivision of the spoils, which has been going on above and below throughout the country, in every department of central and local government. The 6 months between February 27th and August 27th, 1917, can be summed up, objectively summed up, beyond all dispute, as follows. Reforms shelved, distribution of official jobs accomplished, and, quote, mistakes in the distribution corrected by a few redistributions. But the more the bureaucratic apparatus is redistributed among the various bourgeois and petty bourgeois parties, i.e. among the cadets, social revolutionaries, and Mensheviks in the case of Russia, the more keenly aware the oppressed classes and the proletariat at their head become of their irreconcilable hostility to the whole of bourgeois society. Hence the need for all bourgeois parties, even for the most democratic and, quote, revolutionary democratic among them, to intensify repressive measures against the revolutionary proletariat, to strengthen the apparatus of coercion, i.e., of the state machine. This course of events compels the revolution to concentrate all its forces of destruction against the state power, and to set itself the aim not of improving the state machine, but of smashing and destroying it. It was not logical reasoning, but actual developments, the actual experience of 1848-51, that led to the matter being presented in this way. The extent to which Marx held strictly to the solid ground of historical experience can be seen from the fact that, in 1852, he did not yet specifically raise the question of what was to take place of the state machine to be destroyed. Experience had not yet provided material for dealing with this question, which history placed on the agenda later on, in 1871. In 1852, all that could be established with the accuracy of scientific observation was that the proletarian revolution had approached the task of concentrating all its forces of destruction against the state power, of smashing the state machine. Here the question may arise, is it correct to generalize the experience, observations, and conclusions of Marx to apply them to a field that is wider than the history of France during the 3 years of 1848-51? Before proceeding to deal with this question, let us recall a remark made by Engels and then examine the facts. In his introduction to the third edition of the 18th Brumaire, Engels wrote, France is the country where, more than anywhere else, the historical class struggles were each time fought out to a finish, and where, consequently, the changing political forms within which they move and in which their results are summarized have been stamped in the sharpest outlines. The center of feudalism in the Middle Ages, the model country since the Renaissance, of a unified monarchy based on social estates. France demolished feudalism in the Great Revolution and establish the rule of the bourgeoisie in a classical purity unequaled by any other European land. And the struggle of the upward-striving proletariat against the ruling bourgeoisie appeared here in an acute form unknown elsewhere. End quote. The last remark is out of date in so much as since 1871, there has been a lull in the revolutionary struggle of the French proletariat. Although, long as this lull may be, it does not at all preclude the possibility that in the coming proletarian revolution, France may show herself to be the classic country of the class struggle to a finish. Let us, however, cast a general glance over the history of the advanced countries at the turn of the century. We shall see that the same process went on more slowly, in more varied forms, in a much wider field. On the one hand, the development of parliamentary power, both in the republican countries, France, America, Switzerland, and in the monarchies, Britain, Germany to a certain extent, Italy, Scandinavian countries, etc. On the other hand, a struggle for power among the various bourgeois and petty bourgeois parties which distributed and redistributed the spoils of office, with the foundations of bourgeois society unchanged. And lastly, the perfection and consolidation of the executive power, of its bureaucratic and military apparatus. There is not the slightest doubt that these features are common to the whole of the modern evolution of all capitalist states in general. In the last 3 years, 1848 to 1851, France displayed, in a swift, sharp, concentrated form, the very same processes of development which are peculiar to the whole capitalist world. Imperialism, the era of bank capital, the era of gigantic capitalist monopolies, of the development of monopoly capitalism into state monopoly capitalism, has clearly shown an unprecedented growth in its bureaucratic and military apparatus in connection with the intensification of repressive measures against the proletariat, both in the monarchical and in the freest republican countries. World history is now undoubtedly leading, on an incomparably larger scale than in 1852, to the, quote, concentration of all the forces of the proletarian revolution on the destruction of the state machine. What the proletariat will put in its place is suggested by the highly instructive material furnished by the Paris Commune. Section 3. The Presentation of the Question by Marx in 1852. In 1907, Mehring, in the magazine Neue Zeit, footnote, Die Neue Zeit, New Times, theoretical journal of the German Social Democratic Party, published in Stuttgart from 1883 to 1923. It was edited by Karl Kautsky till October 1917, and by Heinrich Kuhnau in the subsequent period. It published some of Marx's and Engels' writings for the first time. Engels offered advice to its editors and often criticized them for their departures from Marxism. In the second half of the 90s, upon Engels' death, the journal began systematically to publish revisionist articles, including a serial by Bernstein entitled Problems of Socialism, which initiated a revisionist campaign against Marxism. During the First World War, the journal adhered to a centrist position and virtually hacked the social chauvinists. End footnote. Mehring, in the magazine Die Neue Zeit, published extracts from Marx's letter to Wedemeyer, dated March 5, 1852. This letter, among other things, contains the following remarkable observation, beginning of quote. And now, as to myself, No credit is due to me for discovering the existence of classes in modern society, or the struggle between them. Long before me, bourgeois historians had described the historical development of this class struggle, and bourgeois economists, the economic anatomy of classes. What I did that was new was to prove, one, that the existence of classes is only bound up with particular historical phases in the development of production, and two, that the class struggle necessarily leads to the dictatorship of the proletariat, and three, that this dictatorship itself only constitutes the transition to the abolition of all classes and to a classless society. End quote. In these words, Marx succeeded in expressing with striking clarity, first, the chief and radical difference between his theory and that of the foremost and most profound thinkers of the bourgeoisie, and secondly, the essence of his theory of the state. It is often said and written that the main point in Marx's theory is the class struggle, but this is wrong. And this wrong notion very often results in an opportunist distortion of Marxism and its falsification in a spirit acceptable to the bourgeoisie. For the class struggle was not created by Marx, but by the bourgeoisie before Marx, and generally speaking, it is acceptable to the bourgeoisie. Those who recognize only the class struggle are not yet Marxists. They may be found to be still within the bounds of bourgeois thinking and bourgeois politics. To confine Marxism to the theory of class struggle means curtailing Marxism, distorting it, reducing it to something acceptable to the bourgeoisie. Only he is a Marxist who extends the recognition of the class struggle to the recognition of the dictatorship of the proletariat. This is what constitutes the most profound distinction between the Marxists and the ordinary petty, as well as the big bourgeois. This is the touchstone on which the real understanding and the recognition of Marxism should be tested. And it is not surprising that when the history of Europe brought the working class face to face with this question as a practical issue, not only all the opportunists and reformists, but all the Kautskyites, people who vacillate between reformism and Marxism, proved to be miserable Philistines and petty bourgeois democrats reputing the dictatorship of the proletariat. Kautsky's pamphlet, The Dictatorship of the Proletariat, published in August 1918, i.e., long after the first edition of this present book, is a perfect example of petty bourgeois distortion of Marxism and base renunciation of it in deeds, while hypocritically recognizing it in words. See my pamphlet, The Proletarian Revolution and the Renegade Kautsky. Opportunism today, as represented by its principal spokesman, the ex-Marxist Karl Kautsky, fits in completely with Marx's characterization of the bourgeois position quoted above. For this opportunism limits recognition of the class struggle to the sphere of bourgeois relations. Within this sphere, within its framework, not a single educated liberal will refuse to recognize the class struggle in principle. Opportunism does not extend recognition of the class struggle to the cardinal point, to the period of transition from capitalism to communism, to the overthrow and complete abolition of the bourgeoisie. In reality, this period inevitably is a period of unprecedentedly violent class struggle in unprecedentedly acute forms, and consequently, during this period, the state must inevitably be a state that is democratic in a new way for the proletariat and the propertyless in general, and dictatorial in a new way against the bourgeoisie. Further, the essence of Marx's theory of the state has been mastered only by those who realize that the dictatorship of a single class is necessary not only for every class society in general, not only for the proletariat, which has overthrown the bourgeoisie, but also for the entire historical period which separates capitalism from classless society, i.e. from communism. Bourgeois states are most varied in form, but their essence is the same. All these states, whatever their form, in the final analysis, are inevitably the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. The transition from capitalism to communism is certainly bound to yield tremendous abundance and variety of political forms, but the essence will inevitably be the same, the dictatorship of the proletariat. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3. Experience of the Paris Commune of 1871. Marx's Analysis. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Section 1. What made the Communards' attempt heroic? It is well known that in the autumn of 1870, a few months before the Commune, Marx warned the Paris workers that any attempt to overthrow the government would be the folly of despair. But when, in March 1871, a decisive battle was forced upon the workers and they accepted it, when the uprising had become a fact, Marx greeted the proletarian revolution with the greatest enthusiasm, in spite of unfavorable auguries. Marx did not persist in the pedantic attitude of condemning an, quote, untimely movement, as did the ill-famed Russian renegade from Marxism, Plekhanov, who, in November 1905, wrote encouragingly about the workers' and peasants' struggle, but after December 1905, cried, liberal fashion, they should not have taken up arms. Marx, however, was not only enthusiastic about the heroism of the Communards, who, as he expressed it, stormed heaven. Although the mass revolutionary movement did not achieve its aim, he regarded it as a historic experience of enormous importance, as a certain advance of the world proletarian revolution, as a practical step that was more important than hundreds of programs and arguments. Marx endeavored to analyze this experiment, to draw tactical lessons from it, and re-examine his theory in the light of it. The only correction Marx thought it necessary to make to the Communist Manifesto, he made on the basis of this revolutionary experience of the Paris Commune. The last preface to the new German edition of the Communist Manifesto, signed by both its authors, is dated June 24, 1872. In this preface, the authors, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, say that the program of the Communist Manifesto, quote, has in some details become out of date, and go on to say, quote, one thing especially was proved by the Commune, that the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. The authors took the words that are in single quotation marks in this passage from Marx's book, The Civil War in France. Thus, Marx and Engels regarded one principal and fundamental lesson of the Paris Commune as being of such enormous importance that they introduced it as an important correction into the Communist Manifesto. Most characteristically, it is this important correction that has been distorted by the opportunists, and its meaning probably is not known to 9/10, if not 99/100, of the readers of the Communist Manifesto. We shall deal with this distortion more fully farther on, in a chapter devoted specially to distortions. Here it will be sufficient to note that the current vulgar interpretation of Marx's famous statement just quoted is that Marx here allegedly emphasizes the idea of slow development in contradiction to the seizure of power, and so on. As a matter of fact, the exact opposite is the case. Marx's idea is that the working class must break up, smash the ready-made state machinery, and not confine itself to merely laying hold of it. On April 12, 1871, i.e., just at the time of the Commune, Marx wrote to Kugelmann, quote, "If you look up the last chapter of my 18th Brumaire, you will see that I declare that the next attempt of the French Revolution will be no longer, as before, to transfer the bureaucratic military machine from one hand to another, but to smash it. And this is the precondition for every real people's revolution on the continent. And this is what our heroic party comrades in Paris are attempting." The letters of Marx to Kugelmann have appeared in Russian in no less than 2 editions, one of which I edited and supplied with a preface. End quote. The words, "to smash the bureaucratic military machine," briefly express the principal lesson of Marx regarding the tasks of the proletariat during a revolution in relation to the state. And this is the lesson that has not only been completely ignored, but positively distorted by the prevailing Kautskyite interpretation of Marxism. As for Marx's reference to the 18th Brumaire, we have quoted the relevant passage above in full. It is interesting to note, in particular, 2 points in the above-quoted argument of Marx. First, he restricts his conclusion to the continent. This was understandable in 1871, when Britain was still the model of a purely capitalist country, but without a militarist clique, and, to a considerable degree, without a bureaucracy. Marx therefore excluded Britain, where a revolution, even a people's revolution, then seemed possible, and indeed was possible, without the precondition of destroying ready-made state machinery. Today, in 1917, at the time of the first great imperialist war, this restriction made by Marx is no longer valid. Both Britain and America, the biggest and the last representatives in the whole world of Anglo-Saxon, quote, liberty, in the sense that they had no militarist cliques and bureaucracy, have completely sunk into the all-European filthy, bloody morass of bureaucratic military institutions, which subordinate everything to themselves and suppress everything. Today, in Britain and America too, the precondition for every real people's revolution is the smashing and the destruction of the ready-made state machinery, made up and brought up to the European general imperialist perfection in those countries in the years of 1914 to 17. Secondly, particular attention should be paid to Marx's extremely profound remark that the destruction of the bureaucratic military state machine is, quote, the precondition for every real people's revolution. This idea of a people's revolution seems strange coming from Marx, so that the Russian Plekhanovites and Mensheviks, those followers of Struve who wish to be regarded as Marxists, might possibly declare such an expression to be a slip of the pen on Marx's part. They have reduced Marxism to such a state of wretchedly liberal distortion that nothing exists for them beyond the antithesis between bourgeois revolution and proletarian revolution. And even this antithesis they interpret in an utterly lifeless way. If we take the revolutions of the 20th century as examples, we shall, of course, have to admit that the Portuguese and the Turkish revolutions are both bourgeois revolutions. Neither of them, however, is a people's revolution, since in neither does the mass of the people, their vast majority, come out actively, independently, with their own economic and political demands to any noticeable degree. By contrast, although the Russian bourgeois revolution of 1905-07 displayed no such, quote, brilliant successes as at that time fell to the Portuguese and Turkish revolutions, it was undoubtedly a real people's revolution, since the mass of the people, their majority, the very lowest social groups, crushed by oppression and exploitation, rose independently and stamped on the entire course of the revolution the imprint of their own demands, their attempt to build, in their own way, a new society in place of the old society that was being destroyed. In Europe, in 1871, the proletariat did not constitute the majority of the people in any country on the continent. A people's revolution, one actually sweeping the majority into its stream, could be such only if it embraced both the proletariat and the peasants. These two classes then constituted the people. These two classes are united by the fact that the bureaucratic military state machine oppresses, crushes, exploits them. To smash this machine, to break it up, is truly in the interest of the people, of their majority, of the workers, and most of the